The only thorn in my father's side, besides my anxious mother, was his partner in both the New York and Florida clubs, E.M. Lowe. Perhaps because the one in New York was known as Lou Walter's Latin Quarter, and my father was well known, the celebrity, E.M., as he was always called, felt compelled to throw his weight around. He had a lot of weight. He was a large man, loud and vulgar, and he tried his best to make my father seem small, and not just in physical size. He was heavy-handed, the kind of man who would whack you on the back to make a point. He spoke with a thick Russian accent. Well, so did my beloved grandmother, but when Lowe spoke, it was guttural, and he often spit as he talked. He always called my father Louis. My father hated being called Louis. Still, I think my father could probably have lived with that. The real problem was that Lowe was a bottom-line bean counter, the dark counterforce to my father's dazzle. He fought every production penny my father spent, every hand-sewn sequin, everything that made the Latin Quarter so singular and special. "Louis," Lowe would say, "why do you have to get new costumes for the finale? Keep last year's. Who will know the difference?" E.M.'s wife, Sonia, was also hard to take. She was noisy and proprietary at the Latin Quarter, demanding special service, ordering everyone around. "I am Mrs. E.M. Lowe," she would proclaim. "I own this place." While we always sat with my father in the back of the club, Sonia insisted on being seated at a table in the front row, though those prime ringside tables should have gone to paying customers. She always had half a dozen hangers-on at her table who drank too much, as did Sonia. Perhaps you have picked up on the fact that the Lowes were not my favorite couple. In retrospect, however, I have to admit that Lowe's iron hand on the Latin Quarter's purse strings probably accounted for my father's spectacular 15-year run in New York. By reining him in, Lowe boosted the club's profit margin. But I couldn't forgive him for diminishing my father. Even though I had my own problems with Lou Walters, I recognized his dignity. And after all, he was my father. Mercifully, Lowe lived in Boston and was not always on the scene in New York. When he did come, it was as if darkness descended. I had murderous dreams about Lowe. They were sometimes so real to me that in my fantasies I tried to figure out how I could get away with his murder. Of course, I didn't kill E.M. Lowe, and he would outlive my father by 7 years, dying in 1984. I did not go to his funeral. During my last 2 years of high school, I was having smooth sailing. I was unhappy at first that Fieldston had refused to readmit me, thanks to my erratic attendance record, but I soon made new friends at Birchwathen. Again, I studied hard and got good grades. I began to date. Mostly, we went to the movies or to another friend's house. Sex was not even a remote consideration. We were years away from the birth control pill. All my girlfriends were virgins. Me too. It was a special time to be in New York. On Broadway, a whole new kind of musical was gathering steam, shows with songs and lyrics that sprang from and were integrated into the plot. My father took us to many opening nights, and those evenings were as glamorous as you could get. Women dressed in long gowns, often with pearls around their necks, and sometimes white ermine coats over their shoulders. Men wore tuxedos. I marvel today when I go to the theater and see much of the audience in jeans and t-shirts. My father took us to the opening of Oklahoma, which made show business history thanks to its glorious score by Rodgers and Hammerstein, and ushered in what became known as the Golden Age of musicals. We saw them all. We went to the opening of the revival of the 1927 epic Showboat, to the romantic Carousel, also by Rodgers and Hammerstein at the Majestic Theater, to Irving Berlin's Annie Get Your Gun, which starred Ethel Merman. I'll never forget the opening night of South Pacific in 1949, with another exquisite score by Rodgers and Hammerstein and opera bass Ezio Pinza singing Some Enchanted Evening to Mary Martin. During this period, My whole life felt enchanted. Our summers were as busy as our winters. At this time, there were quite a few big rambling resort hotels that were open only in the summer. The Lido in Long Island, another, the Griswold in Connecticut, still another, the Sagamore in upstate New York's Adirondack Mountains. We went to all of them. They were full of kids my age and were very popular. On weekends, the women got dressed up and decked themselves out with all their jewelry. The men, who came from the city only for the weekends, wore dark blue suits and ties. During the week, the wives took dance lessons, and on weekends, they showed off their fancy new rumba steps to their husbands. We teenage kids took dance lessons, too. One of the instructors had a little crush on me and asked me to dance as often as he could, but he also was paid to dance with my sister. Jackie had no sense of rhythm and sort of had to be pushed around the floor, but she loved it. I had to promise the instructor that I would give him one dance for every dance he gave Jackie. Otherwise, she just would mostly have sat on the sidelines. In my senior year at Birchwathen, the subject turned to college. I wanted more than anything to go to Wellesley, a renowned all-female college then and now on the outskirts of Boston, and I applied there. Some of the smartest women I would come to know later in my life graduated from Wellesley, women like Hillary Clinton, Lynn Scher, and Diane Sawyer. I also applied to Pembroke College in Rhode Island as my safe choice. My third application went to a small college located in Bronxville, a town in nearby Westchester. The college was named Sarah Lawrence. Sarah Lawrence was an all-female college barely 20 years old and considered to be very avant-garde and progressive in its education. There were no exams, no required core curriculum, and no actual grades. You took only three major subjects per semester and worked closely with a professor who, following the British tradition, was known as your advisor, or Don. It was a college that attracted the adventurous, the arty, the self-starter scholar, and the debutante. I was none of the above, but I applied because my then-best friend Shelby was applying. Sarah Lawrence had a unique admissions process. When you applied, you were sent a form and asked to write answers to specific questions, such as, name two books you have read recently which you disliked, tell why, and are you concerned with any problem in the fields of government, politics, or economics about which you would like to learn more, why? These questions are actually lifted verbatim off my own 50-year-plus-old admission application, which, at my request, Sarah Lawrence recently sent me as research for this book. I did fine on the two books I disliked, Eminent Victorians by Lytton Strachey, whom I criticized for his lack of color and realism in his characterizations, and The Snake Pit by Mary Jane Ward for being repetitious and not offering the slightest hint as to how to remedy the sorry conditions in mental hospitals. I also did fine on the government question, waxing on and on in my cramped little handwriting about the battle of labor versus capital, about which I cared little, to be honest, but was prompted by reading about a series of recent strikes, a teacher strike and one targeting AT&T. However, my hair stood on end when I read the barefaced lies I proffered to Sarah Lawrence so many years ago. My response to "What has meant most to you in your education outside of school?" was Sunday school, which helped me appreciate the force of God and enabled me to increase my faith and understanding in His power. Well, I never, ever went to Sunday school. Did I think a nun was going to read my application and then absolve me of my sin? I must have, because I can come up with no other explanation. Another whopper came in my answer about the experience I had had in the arts. While part of my answer was true, I was indeed particularly fond of dramatics. I had been in several school plays since my debut as a bird. What was unbelievable was my claim that I had worked in a summer stock company in Connecticut and, so gained much valuable technical experience. Good heavens, I never worked in summer stock in my life. Thank goodness Sarah Lawrence never checked the facts. But what was really myth-shattering was the portion of the admission forms assigned to my parents. All my life, I thought my mother had filled it out and that my father had added one withering, dismissive line, "Barbara is a very normal girl with normal interests, period." I thought he hadn't given the whole thing much thought. But no, looking at the original admission forms, it turned out to be my father who had written the entire 4-page evaluation, and it was immensely tender. Asked about my high school experiences, he wrote that I took a good interest in my schoolwork, that I was proud of my good work and good marks, that I make friends easily and hold them. Asked about my interests, he described me as being literary-minded, and backed it up by saying that I read a great deal. He also wrote that I was interested in dramatic theatricals, had both initiative and creative ability, and that I expressed myself clearly and tersely. As to what present interests, if any, he would like me to outgrow, he replied that I had no trait that upset him, nor did I appear to him to have any bad habits. All this he summed up at the end in that one sentence about my being a normal girl. That's probably what got me into Sarah Lawrence. But he was no normal average American father. I held that against him for years, and judged what I had always thought to be his one-sentence contribution to the application as proof that he didn't know me at all. Reading now what he actually wrote, I realize that it's quite the opposite. I didn't know him. In any event, I went off to visit Wellesley and was immensely impressed. Along with Shelby, I also visited Sarah Lawrence for a personal interview. The school seemed small, which I liked, but my heart wasn't there. This is what happened. Wellesley put me on the waiting list. I would not know until late summer whether they would have room for me. Pembroke, my safe school, turned me down. Sarah Lawrence wanted me. I was back to the insecurity of Kappa Pi versus Lambda Pi. What if Wellesley didn't accept me after all? Where would I go? I had applied to only those three schools. I didn't have the confidence to wait to see if Wellesley might take me, or the courage to call the school and try to convince them that I would be a perfect candidate. So Sarah Lawrence it would be. Sarah Lawrence. I never took a science course at Sarah Lawrence College. I never took a comparative religion course or a language course or a math class. For years afterward, I used to say I didn't learn a thing, and I would jokingly add that if I had, I might have made something of myself. But when I read the course material Sarah Lawrence recently sent me, I realized that was not true. Part of the reason I didn't delve into the more important academic subjects was that I took a course called theater for my entire 4 years. At Sarah Lawrence, you signed up to take 3 major subjects in 3 different areas. One of the majors was theater. This was amazing to me. One could really just study theater. It was also a solution to a real dilemma. I had absolutely no idea what I really wanted to do when I grew up. Perhaps because I had spent my whole life in the world of show business, going to clubs and plays and meeting performers and behind-the-scenes people, I thought theater was where I belonged. For me, lacking any other direction, it certainly seemed like a promising course to take. I liked the idea of learning how to construct scenery, familiarizing myself with costume design and lighting techniques. But most of all, it was the idea of acting that interested me. I could imagine losing myself in the role of a totally different person. Somehow, I felt I would be able to do that. We were also assigned great plays to read, among them The Glass Menagerie by Tennessee Williams, A Bill of Divorcement by Clements Dane, T.S. Eliot's The Cocktail Party, and plays by Anton Chekhov and Sean O'Casey. I was especially moved by The Glass Menagerie, because it reminded me so much of my sister's situation. In the play, there is a rather frantic southern mother who is trying desperately to find a gentleman caller for her emotionally and physically fragile daughter, who spends her days playing with her tiny glass animals. There is also a son, and when the mother too often forces him to find gentleman callers, he abandons the family and is then racked with guilt. Although the situation was not exactly like mine, it was similar enough to resonate with me then and even today. To my joy, in my freshman year, I auditioned for and won the part of Mary Boyle, the lead in Sean O'Casey's Juno and the Paycock. We performed the play for 3 days. The audience was made up of students and any residents of the neighboring towns who might want to come. I remember the thrill of hearing applause and the joy of getting laughs, especially when the laughs came where they belonged. In many of my future interviews with actors, I so often heard that it was in college or university that they first got the acting bug. That was the case with me. I was going to be an actress. I had found my calling. I did take other courses. I was told that I should consider a science course, so I took something called Psychology of Art, in which I learned that the color red attracts more people than does blue. That, at least, was helpful later on in deciding what to wear for interviews. I also took a superb literature course and in one spring semester alone read Tolstoy, Thurber, Dewey, and Freud. I took a class taught by Joseph Campbell on the importance of mythology, and I took writing courses because I thought if I didn't make it as an actress, I might be a writer. I remembered writing a very somber paper on death. I guess I was trying to explore some of the mysteries of being alive, because in addition to writing about death, I also wrote a term paper on love. Is romantic love a genuine emotion? Is it something chemical? Is it an invention of Western society? I still haven't a clue. But now one reads that a possible source of romantic love is chemical and the result of a particular scent. So perhaps love is about taking the right nose drops. Who knew? Sarah Lawrence was a wonderful environment in which to learn. The classes were very small, anywhere from 6 to 12. We didn't sit in orderly rows, but around tables. What we did was talk, and discuss, and talk some more. I learned to ask questions and to listen. I learned never to be afraid of speaking up. Every student's point of view was taken seriously, and no one ever said, "That's stupid," or "That's irrelevant." Our dons oversaw all of our courses, addressed any personal or academic problems we might have, and in general, kept us on the right track. We were also expected to write very lengthy reports on an area of our particular course that most interested us. I didn't know how to type in those days, and my handwriting is small and cramped. How any of my professors waded through my reports is a miracle to me. Once written, these reports were dissected and discussed with each of us. All this required a great deal of original thought, research, and organization, which I am certain has helped me with my work, even to deciding which stories I choose to do. I lived in a dormitory called Titsworth, named after an early benefactor of the school, Julia Titsworth. You can imagine the jokes, but I loved the name. We even had a song I can sing to this day. It goes, "My girl's from Titsworth. She's really down to earth. I get my money's worth from progressive education." We all lived in suites, two bedrooms with a bathroom in between. I was very fortunate my first year to have a brilliant roommate named Myra Cohn, who later became a poet and an author of children's stories. Myra was a senior who had asked for a freshman to be her suite mate, and the college picked me. Myra was the sort of person who wrote impassioned political letters to the school newspaper, but also, incongruously, played the tuba. Why? To develop her lower lip, she said. My 4 years in Titsworth spawned other enduring friendships. One was with Marcia Barnett, who called me Bobby, a nickname that stuck for 4 years. In turn, I called her Mike. Another was with a tall, awkward, funny lady named Anita Coleman, to whom I remained close until the day she died of cancer. Her daughter, Leanne, is my godchild. Then there was, and is, Joan Rosen, whose father was a judge in Maine. Joan went on to marry Dr. Paul Marks, the longtime president and CEO of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York. Joan decided in our junior year that our little group at Titsworth wasn't serious enough, so she moved to another dorm. That same year, I was elected president of Titsworth, an office that came with a seat on the College Student Council. I had no interest whatsoever in the Student Council, but I loved getting Joan, because I, the unserious one, served on the Student Council for 2 years and she did not. Nonetheless, Joan and I have been friends for life. She is a very special and accomplished woman who for 26 years directed the graduate program in human genetics at Sarah Lawrence, which many universities used as a model, and founded and directed the first graduate program in health advocacy, also at Sarah Lawrence. Both graduate programs bear her name. Sarah Lawrence was particularly conducive to forging relationships. None of us needed a psychiatrist because we lived in group therapy every day. There were no secrets among us, no privacy. There was one payphone per floor, and when it rang, whoever answered it would scream the girl's name, as well as her callers. For almost 2 years, I mostly dated doctors. Usually, they were young residents. Through one, I would meet another. Marcia Barnett, a.k.a. Mike, was going out with someone at Yale Law School, so eventually I switched from doctors to lawyers. I spent a lot of time at Yale. I hated the football games I had to attend, but I definitely enjoyed the stirrings of my sexuality. One law student boyfriend would take me back to my hotel room after the evening's major activity, which was usually drinking rum and coke from paper cups. There was no question of his spending the night. Those were very innocent days. But I remember pretending to fall asleep so that he could touch my breasts under my sweater. Though kissing was okay, God forbid you should act as if you enjoyed what we called petting. By feigning sleep, I reasoned, he wouldn't think I enjoyed it. But I did. Sarah Lawrence was only half an hour from the city, and I went to New York on most weekends. So that you don't think that sex was the only thing on my mind, I sometimes went to Greenwich Village to listen to the lectures given by one of my professors, William Phillips. Phillips, the co-founder of the Partisan Review, was an intellectual of the highest order, and I was all puffed up when he took a liking to me. The college's proximity to New York also lured people who otherwise might not have wanted to teach at a far-off campus. One was the noted British poet Stephen Spender. I loved listening to his voice and the way he used language so easily and melodiously. It was easy to go home for the weekends, but the situation there was still depressing. My father was hardly ever there. Not only was he moving back and forth between Miami Beach and New York, he was also traveling extensively through Europe in search of new acts and talent. That left my mother and Jackie on their own. Almost every single night, my mother took Jackie to the movies. When they ran out of new American movies to see, they went to French or Spanish films. Even though Jackie had difficulty reading subtitles, anything just to pass the evening hours. Then, a miracle. I passed along a suggestion from Bobby Altman, a friend at Sarah Lawrence, that my parents buy a television set for Jackie. Television, relatively new, had been a lifeline for Bobby's sister, who had cerebral palsy. And so a bulky black-and-white Dumont television set became the center of my sister's life. Television was particularly entertaining for her because she knew so many of the popular performers, like Milton Berle and Jackie Gleason, both of whom had worked for my father. There were several variety shows on the air at the time, and most of them featured the same jugglers, plate spinners, and singers who had appeared at one Latin Quarter or the other. Television provided great entertainment for Jackie, but I don't think any of us realized the impact it would have on our lives. I don't mean just on my own future. It wasn't only Jackie who loved to stay at home to be entertained. soon it would be the rest of America, which meant that people would not be going out to see showgirls, no matter how extravagantly they were dressed or undressed. The rise of television was the beginning of the end of my father's success. It was always with a sense of relief that I returned to my new life at Sarah Lawrence. President Harold Taylor and his rather haughty wife, Grace, often invited teachers and students to their off-campus house for meetings, lectures, and stimulating conversations. We'd sit on the floor in their house with their big sheepdog, Ben, talking, talking, and talking. Much of the talk at the Taylors' was political. The country was in the midst of the tense period with the communist Soviet Union following World War II. The Cold War had spawned such paranoia that Congress was investigating anyone suspected of having even the slightest connection to the Communist Party. The House Un-American Activities Committee was targeting the motion picture industry at the time, blacklisting any actor, writer, producer, or director who wouldn't cooperate or name names. A Senate subcommittee was investigating subversive activities among college faculties, and progressive Sarah Lawrence was a prime target. The American Legion had pointed the finger at the college, specifically at Harold Taylor, for harboring suspected communists on the faculty. Soon after I graduated, some faculty members were called to testify before the Senate subcommittee. I must admit, I hadn't felt terribly involved until this took place. Then the witch hunt hit home. Those faculty members were people I knew and respected. This was not something happening in someone else's world. It was happening in mine. But all this occurred after I left college. In the meantime, like most of the rest of the country, I was a bystander. On and off campus, we watched with fascination the commie-baiting tactics of Wisconsin Senator Joseph McCarthy, who was busily accusing members of the State Department and, later, even the Army, of being communists. Along with my friends, I was appalled at the obsessive destruction of people's lives by the small, powerful cadre of accusers. One of them was Roy M. Cohn. He burst into the Sarah Lawrence consciousness in 1951 as the relentless 24-year-old assistant district attorney in New York who was successfully prosecuting a couple named Ethel and Julius Rosenberg for allegedly conspiring to pass secrets about the atom bomb to the Russians. It was primarily Cohn's cross-examination of Ethel's brother that cemented the Rosenbergs' guilt. Not content with obtaining a prison term, Cohn pressed the court for the death sentence and got it. The Rosenbergs were sentenced to die in the electric chair at Sing Sing Prison, a maximum security facility not far from Sarah Lawrence. I can't begin to tell readers who are too young to have lived through the Rosenberg trial what firestorms it set off. Tens of thousands of people around the world protested the death sentence. The papers were full of pictures of the Rosenbergs' about to be orphaned young sons, then 6 and 10. Arguments raged as to whether the Rosenbergs were framed or whether they really were traitors. And Roy Cohn was at the epicenter. He quickly became public enemy number one on the Sarah Lawrence campus as he relentlessly pursued supposed communists. He had already become a key player in the successful conviction of one suspected communist, a former member of the Commerce Department, for perjury, and had zealously prosecuted 11 members of the Communist Party for sedition. But the death sentence in the Rosenberg case made Cohn a living Satan. It was the talk of the campus, the country, the world. Yet I don't remember having a single conversation about the Rosenberg case, Roy Cohn or Senator McCarthy, with my mother or father. Politics were just not a part of their life. As for me, I was becoming more and more absorbed in my desire to be an actress. I began to doubt that college was the right place for me, and in my junior year I came close to dropping out of Sarah Lawrence altogether. I had been sick that fall with mononucleosis and had missed quite a lot of school, so perhaps my bonds to the college had been weakened. I had loved my leading role in Juno and the Paycock, and later playing the major part in George Bernard Shaw's Candida. This was a wonderful role for a woman, although she should have been played by someone more mature than I. The play's director had his problems with me because I was very shy about onstage physical contact with the actor I was supposed to be married to. My character, the wife of a preacher, was having a love affair with a young poet. In the meantime, her husband was beseeching her to stay with him. "You're supposed to have some signs of a sexual relationship with your husband," the director said in frustration. "Stroke his arm. Put your hand on his knee." But I was so uncomfortable at the prospect that I could barely touch him. I think I still had to pretend to be asleep to have any physical contact. But I did well enough so that I received, if not a standing ovation, at least healthy applause at my curtain call. I was now certain that greatness lay ahead of me on the stage, so I went to see Esther Rauschenbusch, the dean of the college, and told her I was thinking about leaving Sarah Lawrence to pursue my acting career. To my surprise, she was supportive. "College isn't for everybody," she said. "If you're really serious about this, then you should try." I had expected her to say, "How can you possibly think of leaving? This school can't get along without you." But she didn't, so I took her advice, and I tried. My father, who knew every producer and theatrical agent in town, arranged some auditions for me. Most of the agents said I needed more experience, but one of them, a very well-known agent named Audrey Wood, set up an audition for me to read for a part in an upcoming production of Tennessee Williams' Summer and Smoke. I was incredibly excited. Debuting on Broadway in a Tennessee Williams play was a sure ticket to stardom. But then, 2 days before the audition, I panicked. What if I didn't make it? What if I failed? I knew I would take it personally if I didn't get the part, and I couldn't face the rejection. It was just like being back in high school with the same fear I had of being turned down by a sorority or by the popular girls who didn't want me in their group. I knew then, in my heart, that I didn't have the courage or the confidence to face being rejected, perhaps over and over. I was forced to face the fact that I wasn't going to be a great dramatic actress. I had the pull because of my father's prominence in show business, but I didn't have the push. I never went to the audition. Instead, relieved, I went back to Sarah Lawrence for my last year and graduated. I was even chosen to speak for my classmates at the final class dinner for them and their parents. I realize now that Esther Rauschenbusch was very wise. If she'd said to me, "Oh no, you can't drop out, you must stay here," I would always have thought she'd prevented me from following my calling. By supporting my youthful yearnings, she'd allowed me to find out for myself that I didn't have what it takes. One of my professors already knew that. "Bobby came a long way in developing her talent as an actress this term," she wrote, "but she must learn to evaluate criticism." She obviously knew more about me than I knew about myself. For all the help my father had given me in arranging auditions, I held on to my resentments, perhaps because I still barely knew him. How could I? I hardly ever saw him. I knew, too, that his relationship with my mother was strained, which didn't help endear him to me. I couldn't forget that he'd almost left us. In the summer of my junior year at college, my father took my mother, Jackie, and me on a grand tour of Europe. It should have been a fabulous trip, Paris, the south of France, the Swiss Alps, Venice, but it wasn't. Even though we stayed in the best hotels, the George V in Paris, the Carlton in Cannes, I wanted to be in New York with some new doctor boyfriend, not with my family. Jackie didn't much care where we were, she was just happy that we were all together. I made some friends on the ship, dated a Persian boy a few times in Paris, and also managed to acquire a French boyfriend, so I couldn't have been all that miserable. In the evenings, my father took us to the Lido, the world-famous nightclub with its sensational topless reviews. The Lido's owner, Monsieur Guerin, used to swap shows with my father, so he made sure we had the best table in the house. The trip was an extraordinary experience, and why I didn't recognize it as the dream it was is beyond me. We went to the south of France and spent 3 weeks in Cannes. I got hit on there by the notorious playboy actor Errol Flynn. But I paid him no mind. He was way too old. Far more fun was the group of people my age who were staying at the hotel. The sons and daughters of Hollywood moguls. We went swimming together at the nearby Hotel du Cap during the day and went out together every night. The big fashion then for us American young women was circular felt skirts with big felt poodles pasted on them. They came in all colors and looked great when you were doing the Lindy. We wore two-piece dresses during the day, a little top and skirt to show off our midriffs, but unlike today, no belly button was ever revealed. And we wore panty girdles or garter belts to hold up our stockings. The stockings all had seams running down the back, and you were forever stretching out your legs and looking over your shoulders to make sure the seams were straight. Seamless stockings and pantyhose, a great invention, came later. Our bathing suits were one piece, and white was the favorite color. Bikinis were unheard of. It's amazing to me now that we never wore pants. Shorts, yes, but no pants. I remember my mother buying two pairs of red plaid shorts in Cannes, one for me and the other for Jackie. But even though Jackie and I were sometimes dressed alike, she remained isolated. As much fun as I and the rest of the kids were having, my sister, as ever, was not included, which, also as ever, tinged my good times with guilt. I'm so bored with saying this, but that feeling was pervasive and rarely faded. I look back now and think, oh, my poor father. That trip must have cost him a fortune. He did everything possible to make us all happy. Except for when I was off with my friends, he was with us all the time. He tried to make conversation at dinner, bought us anything we desired. He even danced with us when we were in the nightclubs. I could have lived without this, though my father was a nice dancer. He tried. He really did. I, in turn, remained mostly sullen. How I wish I'd thanked him. And I broke up with my latest doctor boyfriend anyway when I came home. I entered my senior year of college with some trepidation. All my friends seemed to know exactly what they were going to do after graduation. Anita was going to work in an art gallery. Joan was going to be a social worker. Other friends were going to graduate school or to Europe. That left me. What was I going to do with my life? My problem was that there was nothing that I really wanted to do and nothing that I thought I was particularly good at. For 2 minutes, I considered being a teacher, but that required getting a master's degree, and I didn't want to do that. In retrospect, I should have, because if I had, Sarah Lawrence would have had to send the graduate school my numerical grades instead of relying on its progressive no-grade system. To be honest, not knowing my numerical grades and how I stacked up compared to others has bugged me ever since. Was I an A student? A B student? Was I smart? Am I smart? Don't laugh. I still wonder. I wound up taking the path of least resistance and headed home to New York to try and get some kind of job. I had seen an ad somewhere, probably in a bus, that read, IFUCNREDTHS, UCNERNMOPA. If you can read this, you can earn more pay. And so while my friends went on to worthier futures, I went to speed writing school on 42nd Street to prepare to be a who knows what. Television 101. I aced speed writing school. Out of 83 students, I am proud to report that I ranked number one, absolute proof that I excelled at something. The fact that what I had mastered was jotting down baby shorthand that used letters rather than symbols didn't bother me. I also learned how to type on a manual typewriter, a machine that has become so obsolete it's probably displayed now in the Smithsonian. Both skills would serve me well over the years to come, though they didn't get me my first job. My legs did. So said the pink-faced advertising man in search of a secretary, who followed me up the stairs to an employment agency and hired me on the spot. He'd be all but arrested today for such a bald assessment of female anatomy, but it was SOP in the 50s. I did have good legs, and I needed the job. Well, I didn't exactly need a job. My parents would certainly have continued to support me, but I still didn't know what I wanted to do, except that I didn't want to go to graduate school. So, a job it was. What a ridiculous caper it turned out to be. Not only did he hire me, but I managed to get him to hire my friend, Anita Coleman, and she in turn brought in another friend. So there we were, the three of us, at a little advertising agency whose name I can't even remember. The agency placed mail-order ads to sell vials of perfume. The ads read, "Big and inexpensive." We called the agency "Small and Cheap." And though I excelled at typing and taking dictation, I failed carbon paper big time. How to make copies of letters had evidently not been part of my curriculum, so when asked to make 6 copies, I dutifully typed each letter 6 times. We were wondrously inefficient. I lasted there around a year. The novelty of working in the small and cheap advertising and direct mail office cooled off at the same time as my boss was heating up. To show his affection, he even gave me a dog named Raoul, who never obeyed me because I couldn't pronounce my R's too well. I didn't see any future with the pink-faced man with blonde hair who seemed to be perpetually surrounded by the vials of perfume he was promoting, and when he became overly amorous, I decided to leave. Besides, I had a lead on a job in a much more interesting business. Television. I didn't know much, if anything, about the television business then, but I sure knew of the importance of television in people's lives. My mother and Jackie spent hours watching programs like I Love Lucy, Arthur Godfrey and His Friends, Texaco Star Theater, and the Jack Benny program. Television was their main source of diversion. There were 4 networks to choose from: ABC, NBC, CBS, and the short-lived Dumont, all of which started their network programming in the late afternoon. The rest of the day and some of the night belonged to local stations which did their own programming and where I had a lead for a job. A friend of mine, Rhoda Rosenthal, was working at WNBT, NBC's affiliate in New York, and she told me there was an opening in the publicity department. "I got my job," she coached me, "by telling them my father had contacts in show business." A rather startling claim, since her father manufactured dresses. In my first job search, I had deliberately avoided using my father's name, wanting to get a job on my own. But pull was pull. So besides listing my speed writing and typing skills on the job application, plus basic French, I added that I was Lou Walter's daughter and personally knew most of the Broadway columnists. That was true. Sort of. I had shared many a table at the Latin Quarter with columnists like High Gardner, Leonard Lyons, and Earl Wilson, but I had always been in the role of my father's daughter and not of a personal friend. Still, all's fair in love, war, and job applications, and it worked. After a meeting with Ted Kott, a vice president at NBC and the station's general manager, I was sent to meet Phil Dean, the director of publicity, promotion, and advertising, who immediately hired me as his assistant. The two of us were the entire publicity department, which gives you some indication of the infancy of the television industry. Phil was kind and easygoing, but he spent a whole lot more time at Toots Shore's restaurant than he did at the office. Phil claimed he was doing research at the noted hangout for showbiz celebrities and athletes. Yogi Berra, the New York Yankees catcher, once remarked, "Toots Shores is so popular, nobody goes there anymore." But the reality was that he rarely got back to the office before 3 p.m., and when he returned, he was rarely sober. So I wrote nearly all of the WNBT press releases, sometimes a half dozen a day. Learning to write those releases was invaluable experience. Television was considered such minor entertainment at the time that newspapers did not have TV critics. Instead, sports and gossip columnists were expected to add television to their regular beats. As a result, most TV press releases were tossed into their wastebaskets. Some papers even punished a columnist who'd erred in some way by assigning him, there were no hers then, to cover TV. So I learned fast to start each release with a startling fact or a provocative anecdote to catch their attention. Something I still do today with my interviews. I remember one release I sent out, WNBT, to feature a star-studded panel on sex. Sex worked just as well then as now, and it got great pickup. When I wasn't writing releases, I was calling the columnists I knew and planting items about the station's talent. All those years of sitting silently at my father's table at the Latin Quarter really paid off when I actually started talking. The columnists all took my calls, and I got an amazing number of items about our local shows into nationally syndicated columns. I also began to truly appreciate my father's positive reputation and popularity. Then there was another development. I was soon going out with my boss, Ted Cott. Ted, who had two small children and was in the middle of a divorce, was the head of the station and had the reputation at NBC of being brilliant and innovative. Both were true and were what attracted me to him. I was then, and still am, attracted to men who are smart and powerful. I'm not sure why. I think it's because I'd always hoped there would be a strong, successful man to take care of me, so I wouldn't have to take care of myself. Ted was at least 10 years older than I, balding and short with a little bit of a belly. Even with the belly, he was the first man I slept with, in his bachelor apartment in Greenwich Village. To be honest, it wasn't really passion that made me take the plunge. I just thought it was time. I was in my 20s and still a virgin, while many of my friends were not only married but having children. I don't remember many of the details of that night, so it couldn't have been either very wonderful or terrible. I do remember thinking rather sadly that from that moment on, whatever happened for the rest of my life, I would never again be a virgin. But then I told myself to shut up. It's time already, was my silent mantra. Ted, the protege of RCA's pioneering chief, David Sarnoff, knew everybody in the media in New York and entertained quite often at his apartment. I sometimes acted as his hostess and learned the value of networking. Through Ted, I met Tex McCrary and his beautiful model and ex-tennis star wife, Jinx Falkenberg. They had a long-standing radio show, Tex and Jinx, and an extremely popular TV show, At Home. I also became friendly with Eloise McElhone, a very attractive and funny woman who was making the transition from radio to her own show on television. Though I didn't know it then, Eloise would play an important role in my career. Ted was a very creative boss. About a year after I started there in the publicity department, he launched a training program to teach the younger employees how to produce television shows. I drew a daily 15-minute children's program named Ask the Camera. The director was a young redhead named Rune Arledge. Years later, Rune would become head of ABC News and a legend in both the sports and news businesses. But then, he was just a friendly guy who drove his convertible every day to the studio to direct various programs. The format of Ask the Camera was simple. People sent us questions, and we answered them with film clips from our archives. Because we had a relatively small film library, I would often have to make up questions that matched what film we had available. We had a good clip of hippopotamuses, for example, so I wrote the question, "I've always wondered, how does a hippopotamus eat?" Though the ethics may have been questionable, I felt it was okay, because I was acting as a producer, not a journalist. I also wrote the voiceover narration for the show's host, Sandy Becker, and edited the film to fit the time. I got so good at it that eventually I didn't need to use a stopwatch. I could both write copy and edit film almost to the second. I still can. I didn't physically cut the film myself, the film editor did, but we worked it out together, hunched over a machine called a moviola and going through the film clip frame by frame. I'd tell him exactly which scenes I wanted, and he would cut and splice them together into a cohesive whole. I also learned the fundamentals of what made a good story in that tiny editing room. If you have a strong beginning, a must, and a powerful ending, then you don't really need a dramatic middle. That is the formula I still follow today. The production work somehow landed me in one of the first issues of TV Guide. I guess I was a novelty, being both female and the daughter of Lou Walters. I was pleased by the little piece titled Young Producer, which cited me as an example of the bright young people in responsible jobs in television and suggested I was the youngest producer in the field. I still have a copy of that TV guide, dated May 15, 1953. My father was proud of the piece, but he didn't take television very seriously. By 1953, half of all American homes had at least one television set, and more than 7 million new sets would be sold the next year, and again the year after that. But he didn't recognize television as a rival to his nightclubs. When I pointed out to him one night that more people watched the Texan Jinx TV show at home in a day than came to the Latin Quarter in a year, he acknowledged the numbers, then countered, "But my customers pay to see my show." I was, of course, still living with my family. Young single women didn't have their own apartments then, and the penthouse was so huge we certainly weren't on top of one another. At one point, my cousin Selig lived there as well. He, too, was working in television, producing a local cooking show called Josie's Kitchen. One of the segments featured South African lobster tales, which resulted in the South African Lobster Tale Institute, or some such organization, gratefully sending him a huge crate of frozen lobster tales. My parents and Jackie were in Florida, and Selig and I lived on that lobster for weeks. It didn't matter if either of us was eating alone or was having people for dinner. We ate South African lobster tales. For all I know, the people who are currently living in the apartment are still eating South African lobster tails. I'm not going to say that everything I know about television I learned during my tenure at WNBT, but I certainly learned a lot. One lesson was, and is, not to assume anything, especially on live television. I learned that from a famous society gossip columnist at the time, Igor Cassini, who wrote for the New York Journal American under the pseudonym Charlie Knickerbocker. Ted had given Cassini his own talk show, and I was asked to produce it. My job was to write Cassini's introduction on a cue card, as well as the questions he would ask each guest. But we never got past the introduction. I assumed, fool that I was, that Igor Cassini would know his own name, so I simply wrote his initials on the cue card for the introduction. "Good evening," he intoned when we went on the air. "I am IC." For all the fun I was having working at WNBT, which would become WNBC in 1960, I was increasingly not having fun with Ted Kott. I wanted to go out with other men. Ted was jealous and possessive. He repeatedly asked me to marry him, which made me pull away even more. I wasn't in love with him. I was still waiting for the man of my dreams. But Ted persisted to such an extent that he began to wait outside my apartment building on Central Park West for me to come home on nights he knew I was out. It came to a head when I started dating Joe Leff, a highly eligible young bachelor whose family owned a successful knitting business, and whose cousin and sister had both gone to Sarah Lawrence. I liked Joe a lot, which sent Ted over the edge. One night when Joe brought me home, Ted suddenly emerged from the shadows and challenged him to a fist fight, right there on the street. To my horror, they began to struggle and hit each other. Believe me, having two men physically fight over you is not the exciting fantasy some women harbor. Fortunately, they had the good sense to stop attacking each other and to walk away. Needless to say, the incident ended my relationship with Ted and my job at WNBT. Ted had become so obsessive and controlling that I had no choice but to quit. And Joe, whom I really liked, evidently didn't like me all that much. He stopped calling. Ted must have regained his senses after that because he went on to marry a beautiful woman named Sue. Joe, too, moved on and married a beautiful woman named Joyce, who would later become my best friend. After the sidewalk confrontation on Central Park West, however, I was left high and dry. Luckily, a new job quickly materialized, and I went to work at another local New York station, WPIX, on the Eloise McElhone show. I knew Eloise from those parties at Ted's apartment and liked her a lot. She was a little outrageous, a little overweight, and very, very funny. My official title was executive producer, but in reality, I was also associate producer, writer, script girl, guest booker, and coffee maker. Multitasking was the norm in those early days of television when the programs were so understaffed that it never dawned on me to question the workload. We had to fill a half hour every day with anything we could find. Interviews, cooking lessons, fashions, exercise demonstrations, pet advice, even a segment called Answer Your Mail, M-A-L-E, about relationships. I wrote many of the letters Eloise would supposedly receive, as well as the answers to those letters, her introduction of her guests, and the questions she would ask them. I also prepared the graphics, chose the music for each segment, and then sat in the control booth when we went on the air and prayed that somehow it would all work out. To the second. That is why my answer to all the young people who ask me how to get into television is, go to your local television stations, take any job that's offered, and work your fanny off. Volunteer for everything without looking at the time clock. Learn how it all works. Crises happen. Producers don't show up. Guests don't show up. Scripts are lost. Be in place. Make no mistake, television is a demanding business. To be successful in it, you have to be somewhat obsessive, and as a result, it is hell on your social and romantic life. Eloise McElhone paid a price back in the 50s when her husband, perhaps wearying of the hours she was spending away from him and their children, upped and left her for another woman. Eloise went through a very sad time, but I have to admit I was relieved when the show went off the air for the summer. And what a summer it was. I went to Europe with my dear friend from Sarah Lawrence, Anita Coleman. The ostensible reason for our trip was to visit Anita's boyfriend, Warren Manschel, who was working temporarily in Paris, and get him to propose marriage to her. But what I wanted was adventure. We both got what we wanted. Paris, the south of France, Italy. Anita and I each had brief flings with two Italians. Hers was tall, mine was short. These were sun-filled days and starry nights. It was divine. When Anita got back to Paris, Warren proposed, and she accepted. Her parents flew over, and there was a fairy tale wedding on the Isle of Capri. As for me, I was free, free, free. In mid-July, I stopped by an American Express office in Rome to see if I had any mail. American Express was the customary mail drop then for travelers, and found a letter from WPIX informing me that the Eloise McElhone show had been canceled and I was no longer needed. I was thrilled. I jumped up and down on the Spanish steps. I had the rest of the summer to myself. Maybe the fall, too. Maybe my whole life. My parents, always generous, sent me money to stay in Europe. I went back alone to the south of France where I had friends and then moved on to Paris where I decided to live for a while and try to get a job. I found an inexpensive hotel on the left bank, had my hair cut short with bangs like Audrey Hepburn. Young, thin, and American, I got a job modeling for the House of Carvin. Vous avez une bonne taille, Mademoiselle Carvin told me, which meant I was the right size for the petite clothes she was introducing. Can you imagine me, a model in Paris, with Audrey Hepburn hair? There weren't too many American girls in Paris then, and I was a popular novelty. I had many friends and several boyfriends. I even thought I was in love. Fred, a Frenchman, was funny, charming, and somewhat elusive. It was Paris. We had a little affair. He liked me, but he didn't love me, and he sure didn't want to marry me. Tant pis, as they say in Paris. Too bad. My heart hurt a little, but it wasn't broken. It's hard to have a broken heart when you're having the time of your life. I remember walking to the flower market one beautiful early morning and sitting on a bench, surrounded by bouquets of brilliant flowers, and thinking, I'm happy. Utterly and completely happy. As a reminder of that moment of perfect contentment, I later bought a small child Hassam painting of that same flower market. It hangs in the front hall of my apartment in New York, where I see it every time I come in or go out. My father, however, finally put an end to my French idol. It's time for you to come home, he wrote to me in November 1954. Meet me in London. I dutifully went to London, where he was producing a command performance of a Latin Quarter review. A command performance was, and is, a stage show put on at the request of a monarch or a head of state. In London, I looked up friends I had made in the south of France, and I was gloriously wined and dined, which made it somewhat easier not to miss Fred. What wasn't easier, however, was when I realized, to my shock and deep fear, that I had missed my period. I was woefully ignorant of birth control and suddenly terrified that I was pregnant. I remember sneaking off to see a surgeon in London, where they are called Mr., but he wasn't sure whether or not I was pregnant. It was too early to test, and the at-home early pregnancy tests of today had not yet been developed. I didn't know what to do. Abortion was illegal. If indeed I was pregnant, how would I go about getting one? What would I tell my mother? I was frantic. It was a wrenching time for me, and one that has made me even more supportive of women in similar predicaments and their right to choose their own fate. Soon after my father left London to return home, I followed, sailing on the ocean liner, the SS United States. My spirits were decidedly low, my fears high, until suddenly, on the second day at sea, I got my period. I was euphoric during the rest of the voyage, which is probably why I recall so fondly my assigned seatmates at meals, Bob Hope's mother-in-law, Teresa Kelly Defina, and a young Greek shipping heir named Alexander. When I got home, I went down to Florida to visit my parents and Jackie. They were staying at the new, very popular Fontainebleau Hotel, with its lush 20-acre grounds and legendary lagoon pool. I know I should have been agitating to get back to New York and find a job, but I was enjoying my lazy tropical life. I especially enjoyed it when Alexander came to visit me from Palm Beach, where he was staying. But whatever romance there might have been vanished over lunch. My father had a poolside cabana overlooking the ocean, but Alexander, whose taste ran to caviar and champagne, rapidly lost interest in me when he saw the people in the adjacent cabana digging into their corned beef and pastrami sandwiches. Maybe it wasn't just the pastrami, maybe it was also a bit of anti-Semitism. Either way, I never saw Alex again. I did meet two other men during that idyll in Florida, however, who would play pivotal roles in my life. I remained steadfastly loyal to one of them in the face of enormous criticism. The other, I married. Bad Choices. Roy Cohn and Bob Katz. An improbable pairing. They never met each other, but I met both of them, for better or worse, during that leisurely time in Florida. My first meeting with Roy was brief and, for me, quite unpleasant. He was evidently a frequent visitor to the Palm Island Latin Quarter, because when I went to the club one night, there he was, sitting with my father. "This is my daughter Barbara," my father said by way of introduction. She said she wanted to meet you. I immediately corrected him. I am your daughter, I said, but I never said I wanted to meet him. Why would I want to meet Roy Cohn? I detested everything he stood for. After the Rosenberg trial in 1951, he had become even more notorious as chief counsel to the Senate subcommittee investigating American communists, headed by the communist-obsessed Senator Joseph McCarthy. By 1955, the year I met him, Roy had become a national celebrity of sorts from the Army-McCarthy hearings the year before, the first congressional hearings to be nationally televised. 22 million people had watched the gavel-to-gavel coverage of those hearings during the 36-day live television marathon in the spring of 1954. 22 million. It was high drama. There was Roy, with his distinctive slicked-back hair and dark circles under his eyes. I thought he looked like a lizard, sitting by the side of the glowering, satanic McCarthy, leveling charges at everyone who came into their sights. And then, on June 9th, McCarthy went too far. He was in the midst of impugning a young associate of the Army's chief counsel, Joseph Welch, when Welch uttered the famous words that triggered McCarthy's downfall. "Until this moment, Senator, I think I never gauged your cruelty or recklessness," he said. "Have you no sense of decency, sir? At long last, have you left no sense of decency?" And the gallery in the Senate hearing room burst into applause. So unseen, did many in the television audience and others wept happy tears. It was an extraordinary moment. It was as if the bully everyone was terrified of were suddenly stripped naked and people realized there was nothing left to fear. McCarthy's popularity immediately began to plummet, and his reign of ideological terror was over. When the hearings ended inconclusively, Roy resigned, but McCarthy was soon censured by the Senate. He would die, 3 years later, of alcoholism-related hepatitis. Roy, however, managed to rise from the ashes. He was only 28 when I first met him in Florida, and on his way to becoming one of the most powerful and feared lawyers in New York. He also remained one of the most unpopular men in America. No, I did not want to meet him. The man I did enjoy meeting in Florida was Bob Katz, an eligible bachelor considered a catch by many eager young women in Miami. I didn't disagree. I also thought, after my carefree time traipsing around Europe for months, that it was time for me to get married. Bob was 10 years older than I, good-looking in a dark, smoldering way, well-mannered, a good athlete, and a good dancer. If he wasn't powerful, he was certainly an attractive prospect. His father, for whom he worked, was the largest manufacturer of children's hats. Hardly an exciting business, but a very successful one. Most children wore hats then, and everybody had new Easter bonnets. Unlike show business, it was a stable business, which appealed to me for obvious reasons. So I started going out with Bob, whom I immediately nicknamed for my friends, Cat's Hats. I was seeing another man at the same time, Henry Epstein, who was almost the opposite of Bob. I had met Henry in France, and I enjoyed his company enormously. He was very intelligent and intense, unlike Bob, who was quite phlegmatic and didn't seem to have any passion in any direction. But Henry was short and squat and not half as physically attractive as Bob. To me, then in my early 20s, short and squat was a turnoff. Though Henry was much more interesting than Bob and a shrewd businessman, he'd made a small fortune in New York real estate and lived in a penthouse on Fifth Avenue. I thought I was supposed to marry a man my friends and I agreed was attractive and sexy. Most of my pals thought Bob was. So I turned Henry down when he proposed and said yes to Cotts Hats. The truth is, no matter whom I married in those days, it wouldn't have worked out. As I'm sure you can tell by my decision-making process, I didn't know who I was, what I wanted, or where I was going, if anywhere. Young women like me graduated from college, got their first jobs, then left to get married. I'd already had 3 jobs, unlike my friends, who'd all followed the unspoken timetable and been married for several years. And so my rather dreary engagement to Bob Katz began. We spent time with his family. We spent time with my family. My father certainly didn't have much to say to Bob or his father, Ira Katz, manufacturer of children's hats, but then again, neither did I. The boredom grew so heavy that after a couple of months, I broke the engagement. Then 2 things happened. Instead of pleading with me not to leave, Bob agreed easily with my decision to call off the wedding. That bothered me tremendously. I could understand perfectly why I didn't want to marry him, but how could he not want to marry me? I felt rejected and somehow a bit frightened. What was wrong with me? Then there was the bookkeeper at the Katz family business. She hated me, plain and simple. Bob's mother was dead and the bookkeeper had assumed her maternal role. She zealously looked after Bob's father, as well as Bob and his brother, and called them the boys. I was evidently the girl who was going to upset her family, and she made it very clear, in her coldness and sometimes downright nastiness toward me, that I was not welcome. I couldn't handle the rejection, so I overruled my misgivings. I told Bob that I was fully content with him and that I was looking forward to living in his 1-bedroom apartment on Horatio Street in Greenwich Village, a far cry from our penthouse on Central Park West. He must have believed me because I won him back. And I must have believed myself because I tried to woo the bookkeeper as well. For some reason, I thought I had to prove myself to her, to convince her that I was a good person and not some shallow, hedonistic flibbertigibbet. She was constantly warning Bob that I was a spendthrift, so I went to the other extreme. I called her one day to tell her I had bought my entire trousseau wholesale at the designer Anne Klein and my wedding dress on sale at Bergdorf Goodman. I even sent her the receipts to prove my thriftiness. So peace was declared, a formal wedding was planned, as was a return trip to Europe for me, where Bob would also buy supplies for Katz hats. Looking back, it all seems insane, but I know I did it. Maybe it was the 50s you must get married mentality. Maybe it was my strong desire to stabilize my life. In any event, I was determined to marry Bob Katz. Until 2 days before the wedding. Then reality set in. I was marrying a man to whom I had nothing to say. I felt trapped and scared. My mother understood and sent me to talk to my father at the Latin Quarter. He was sympathetic too, but, as so often, removed. He pointed out that the invitations had long since been sent out. The rooms had been booked at the Plaza Hotel for the ceremony and reception. The caterers were lined up, as was the orchestra. There were even matchboxes with our names and the date printed on them in gold script. "My darling, this happens to every bride," he said. "You'll feel better when it's over." And so, in June 1955, my father walked me down the aisle. My sister Jackie was my maid of honor. There were several hundred guests, some of whom, I'm sure, shed a few tears. But I was the one who really wanted to cry. My heart had never felt so heavy, but then again, my heart would feel just as heavy every time I married. I've been married 3 times. Which is why, as I write this, please know that I will never get married again. Years later, when I gained some celebrity on the Today Show, stories about me would refer to my marriage to Bob Katz as Barbara Walters' secret marriage. Well, it was hardly a secret, but it was quite miserable, or at least I was. I won't belabor you with all the details, but I remember that when we weren't sightseeing on our honeymoon, we had little to talk about. I knew in my heart and in my mind that I was not at all in love with Bob, and even though he was physically attractive, I felt little sexual desire for him. During many of the days, Bob was busy buying straw and ribbons for the next season's crop of children's hats. In those times, I did whatever sightseeing Bob wasn't interested in by myself. I was not unhappy then.